So we're going to, I didn't want to get too many notes going in here, just because I can talk a lot on this, and it wouldn't have been good stewardship of anybody's time. But sort of like what we're talking about tonight, we're going to talk about the history of the English Bible. This is our last pastor's Bible study. That will be for the semester, and we'll pick this back up, I think, in September. So we'll have a little summer break. But this will be the last one that we have, so if you show up next week and there's nobody here, it's because this is the last one. But I figured after having talked about sort of the history of Christianity since September of last year till last week, we got all the way from Pentecost all the way up into the modern era. And I figured it would be good, just because we're going to have sort of this add-on week, to be able to give sort of a brief history of the English Bible. We've got some of our notes that have been in the back and so forth, so I want to get through. Feel free to ask questions with this. I sort of got down off the platform just because it's going to work out a little bit better this way. I brought a couple visual aids that we'll be getting into. This is a copy of the 1611 from the Book of Deuteronomy. We'll talk a little bit about that when we touch on it. I think the history of so many things is interesting, but particularly the history of how we have the English Bible and the English Bibles that we have is something that's always good to just be reminded about. A lot of people don't ever really think about the different kinds of Bibles that we have and the different translations and what they all mean. We currently, and this isn't a knock on University Baptist, but sort of where we're at, we've got a whole bunch of pew Bibles in our sanctuary that are NIV 1984s. And there's a new NIV out called the NIV 2011. So if you pull up the NIV notes online, they're in the 2011, and we've got, so there might be a little bit of difference, but I'll talk a little bit towards the end that there's really not that much difference, that we still have faithful translations, and we can be thankful for that. As you can see, this is a history of the English Bible tonight, and you'll see a couple things in our notes. This is a brief study on the development of the Bible in English, with attention paid to the nature of movements in society and in language. Really, when we think about it, the movement of society culturally, politically, economically, but then also and technologically, ultimately also blend into what's happening with what's going on in the nature of language. Language changes. We have not always spoken this kind of English. If you were speaking English, if you go 1,400 years ago back to 600, they would have spoken a form of English that would have made zero sense to where we are. But then there's a progression that happens there. Tonight we're going to cover, and I'm basically, just to let you know, I'm going to run primarily off of my PowerPoint. I've given you a skeleton of notes. I haven't given you everything that's up there. Sort of, I've been doing the reverse, but I figured tonight it might be a little bit better just because I've used this presentation elsewhere to sort of do the reverse. So the majority of our notes will be up there, and I'll be walking through those, but we'll have sort of a skeleton that's faithful to the text in front of us for what we're going. We're going to cover three periods. The early period, up to 1500. The middle period, which is 1500 to 1900. And then the modern period, which is 1900 to today. What's interesting about this is these three periods correspond to the three periods of the development of English. Old English is in the early period, Middle English is in that middle period, and Modern English largely emerges, we'll say around the mid-1800s or so, but where we are today. So there are some changes that happen there. So these are three good periods. Obviously, they're not all symmetric, but there's some stuff that goes in there, and we're going to see why these three periods work in. So that's kind of where we're going to get going and so forth. So let's get underway talking a little bit about the early period that we have here. In particular, we see that there are several translations. So when people say that the first English Bible that was ever translated was the King James 1611, that's not correct. We've had English translations of the Bible or something that's been going on for as long as we've had English, whether it was Old English and so forth. And we can see, I'll have some examples of sort of what was going on up here, as you'll see in the PowerPoint. But we saw a number of different translations. People have always wanted to have the Bible in their vernacular. They've always wanted to have the Bible in their common language. And there's always been that push and that pull and push. Now, the challenge in the early period is if you wanted to have a Bible in your vernacular, it had to be either you had to have it illegally or it had to be sanctioned by the Catholic authorities, and the Catholic authorities weren't going to sanction it because they wanted to have a certain amount of control. There's some theological stuff that was going in there. One of the first was Venerable Bede's translation in 600. We don't have a lot of information about this, but it is out there for sure. But then also the next one, sort of the Gospels, were translated by somebody named Lindisfarne in 900. So we're dealing with things that are very, very old. We don't have complete texts of all this necessarily. The Wessex Gospels, these are all four Gospels. They were translated, we think, in about 990, but we don't have the entire text of this left. The challenge of this period, it's sort of emblematic of the challenge of textual history, which is, by the way, a riveting conversation about the nature of texts from when they got created till we have them today. But this, the Wessex Gospels were created about 990. We found parts of them, and I'm going to show you sort of a part of them here in a few moments, but we found those. Abbot Elfric, and you always want to say it with kind of that English thing because it's got that AE thing going on. Like, I grew up in a county I grew up in. We had something called the Aegis, and this is how they had it on there, the AE, sort of the conjugation that goes there. But Abbot Alfric translated a portion of the Old Testament into the New Testament in about 1000. Also, we had the Hatton Gospels that were produced in the 12th or 13th century. That occurred as well. This is just sort of the rolling thing that's happening. These are things that are going on throughout this period. These are not technical translations. These are people that are working out of the Latin manuscripts, the Latin manuscript that was produced in around 600 by Jerome, which is called the Vulgate. These people would have been using these kinds of things. A lot of them were not formally trained. We're dealing with things going up to the 12th or the 13th century. Then something interesting happens in the 1200s, which is Richard Rolls Salter. One of the things that develops early on when it comes to Christian literature is that there's a lot of interest among whether it's people that are part of monastic life or priests or different bishops in helping Christians devotionally. And one of the best ways to do that is to create a translation of the Book of Psalms. So they create a translation. This was the Psalter, which is Richard Rolls Psalter. All of these are isolated into what we today call the United Kingdom, perhaps part of Normandy and France, but really into that area right there. I mean, well, and I don't want to talk a lot about the nature of the English language, but this is really where the English Bible gets its sort of the seat, and it begins to grow, and we see the things that are happening there. Rusty, I saw a hand. Yeah, he well, everybody was Catholic in about 1000. Yeah. Some of them. What the funny thing is, it's sort of one of these things that happens, and that's a great question. The question is whether he is one. He's Catholic because everybody right now is Catholic, and 1000, the Great Schism hasn't even happened yet. That happens in 1040. But one of the things that goes on is that these people would genuinely just sit down and try to translate something to help people. And then they would maybe encounter some reaction from Rome or from their local dignitaries or local bishops and so forth, or their archbishops. So it wasn't that they were going out of their way to be illegal. They were just trying to help people. And during this entire period, the Roman Catholic Church has just begun to be established. So there's a lot of freedom still. Pope Gregory has just begun, back in the 500s, has transitioned and really helped Rome get established. Rome is pretty much, by this point, it's in devastation because it's been sacked multiple times. It's been held siege by the barbarians and a number of other people. So there's a highly decentralized thing. So a lot of these things naturally come up because people want to help those around them. Now, the other challenge is that there's not more translations because most people couldn't read. Yeah, that's why the daily Catholic Mass was so important. You would go, and whether you attended Mass daily, if you were a really good Catholic, or if you just attended it by a couple times a week, or just on Sabbath or on Sundays, the Mass became very important because that's where you received your sort of your weekly digest of the Word of God. Because with the growing liturgy, with the growing nature of how homilies were done, your priest would get up and give a homily or a sermon, often in Latin. Maybe you wouldn't have understood it, but sometimes they would have done it. There wasn't a lot of conformity yet, so. Some of these just emerge naturally. They're not trying to go out of their way to be mean or try to be illegal or anything like that, which it's a perfectly good question. But whenever you see the abbot right there, that's somebody who was working with a monastery, somebody who was in charge of all that. That's kind of where that goes. Let me give you an example of what this would have looked like. Obviously, this is what we've got here. This is in like Times New Roman, so it doesn't completely match up. But this is the Wessex Gospels, and this is what it looks like if we were to read from Matthew 6, 9 through 13. This is kind of what it would have looked like if we were going to try to get that, if we were going to look at the Wessex Gospels there. And let me go here real quick and see if I can find, and we'll see if we can catch a couple words. Well, this is Old English. How many people read Beowulf? That's Old English. And if you had a particularly gifted English teacher, they would have had you read it in Old English. But they would have also provided you, hopefully, a text that had the modern English with the Old English. This is, let me just read it for you, because Matthew 6, 9 through 13 is the Lord's Prayer. So let's look and see how the Wessex Gospels translate it, this little portion that we have. Our Father, who art in heaven, or who is in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And I just switched over to the Apocrypha. Let me kick back over here. Yeah, that's why you need a Bible. Exactly. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And what's interesting is this leaves it with sort of an amen. So you see, you can pick up a few things here and there, but it doesn't make any sense. There's actually a great video out there on YouTube. There is a couple of guys that are, I think, lecturers or distinguished professors at Oxford who are Shakespeare authorities. And if you look it up and you talk about, and you look up, I think you have to type in how Shakespeare sounded or something like that. They actually have, one of the guys is a linguistics specialist, and he actually recites Shakespeare as it would have been recited when Shakespeare's plays were new. And you can barely understand half of what they're saying, because there's a lot, there's sort of the way that they slide in. It's sort of like how this happens. So that's one of the things that we're going to do. I wanted to give you guys an illustration. For many of these, we're going to try to give you, Matthew was unique, because I couldn't find the Wessex Gospels for our main text. I wanted to use a text we were all familiar with, so I grabbed John 3:16 through 18 for most of our others, just to sort of give you a hint on where things are going. But this is sort of the Lord's Prayer. So you can see, you can pick up a few things if you're trying to work through it. Perhaps the greatest of these translations that came out in the early period were done by someone named John Wycliffe. Now, you can see Wycliffe spelled this way, which is what I prefer, or you can see it spelled another way, which has two F's and an E at the end. But Wycliffe produced perhaps one of the earliest translations that caught on in England. And he did that between 1382 and 1395. To do this, he used the Latin Vulgate for his basis. I should probably get that up there. He used the Latin Vulgate for his textual basis. So he's not working out of the Hebrew for the Old Testament or the Greek for the New Testament. Rather, he's using the Latin because that was the most readily available text to him. Erasmus wasn't around yet. He hadn't created the Textus Receptus. The Hebrew text is not something that most Christians wanted to mess with, because then you had to talk with a bunch of people who were Jewish, and that wasn't very, I was going to say kosher, but during that period, you didn't want to deal with a lot of that. Plus, a lot of them were not well educated with Hebrew and Greek, but they knew Latin, because that was kind of what it was. Now, John Wycliffe was a priest in England at this time. This is the first complete Bible translation into Middle English. There is a transition that happens between the Wessex Gospels and then also where Wycliffe is. There's a transition linguistically from Old English to New English, because it was also like 600 years or 700 years in between what's going on with that. But this is the first complete Bible translation into Middle English. And he does it in stages like everyone else does. He does New Testament, then he gets back into the Old Testament, beginning with Psalms and so forth. See, Wycliffe believed that every Christian should be able to study the Bible for themselves. And in 1382, this was a revolutionary concept because he said each person should be able to study the Bible for themselves. And this is the way that this goes. And he begins changing everything. By this. So several editions emerged, some after his death. He had an early translation, but then a couple of guys that came alongside of him, some Wycliffeites, I guess, or Wycliffeans, then added some additional translations. You can actually go to some sites like BibleStudyTools.com or Bible.com or Blue Letter Bible. You can look up, and they'll actually have versions of Wycliffe's Bible that you can go look at, the translation. And we're going to see a section of it here. He provided the means for all other English translations. Now, Wycliffe's story is interesting. He ends up dying a bit early. He's celebrating Christmas Mass, and he goes and lays down afterwards and has a massive stroke and dies near the end of 1384. But in 1415, the Council of Constance convenes and declares him a heretic and that all of his works should be burned. And that as an additional measure, the council exhumed his body or his corpse and then decided to burn it. And what they did is they exhumed his corpse from sacred ground so he could no longer be buried in a Catholic or a Christian cemetery. They burned him, and then they took his ashes and they scattered them in a river. Now, for us, we're going to say, well, that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, you can do that. I mean, that's not what we're... But back then, they had not developed theologically. They had a very specific view, particularly in the Christian church, of what this all meant. So it's kind of what happens with these guys. So let me give you a couple examples. This is an example of Wycliffe's earliest text. There are some of these still floating around. Do not expect to find them on eBay. But you can go and look at them. If you end up going to the Museum of the Bible that will open up here very soon in Washington, D.C., you'll find some. The provenance is fairly well established, but you can find them in other places. One place that you can go that's rather accessible that you'll be able to find a lot of ancient or old Bible copies is Houston Baptist University. They have a really good display. I've been there, and if you're ever interested, you can do that. Here, I got a little blow-up of this section. Here it is. And you can see a little of what it would have been like. Obviously, you'll note that this was all done by hand because there's not a printing press yet in the West. There was in the East, but we didn't talk to those people. So, but they have, this is all done by hand, but this is a translation. It's hard to kind of see, but you can see a couple things. The Gospel of St. Luke, for as much as many have taken in bond to comply, a treats off, and then he starts getting into this crazy language. But this is the early parts of Middle English. It's sort of an Old English, Middle English blend. I see a hand back there.
And how far did he go with this? I mean, how much did he was able to spread to people
again? It got around England, but because he was declared a heretic, it's very hard to find copies because it was not available to you could, but if you were illiterate, you wouldn't have been interested in it. And if you were poor, you wouldn't have been available to you because these would have been hand copied. But yeah, they were out there. People knew about them. But then the Council of Constance comes along and does what they do and so forth. So was there another hand back there? Okay. All right. But yeah, these would have been available. So that gives you a little quick snapshot of what is going on there. Here is John 3:16 through 18 from Wycliffe's first translation. For God, we can say loved so the world that he yaf his, I get cut off here, so you'll have to forgive me, his unbegotten son, that ish man who believeth in him perish not, but have everlasting life. Well, what's interesting here is because there's no standardized, we benefit from a ton of stuff in 21st century America. We have standardized language. We can go to dictionaries and say, or we can go to Google and we can say, how do you spell this word? And they'll tell us. But here, what they were trying to do is they were taking the vernacular and the language that was in place, and they were trying to create the right consonants and vowels. So you see a lot of these that blend together. So it gives you, for God sent not his son into the world that he yuge the world. That word yuge is the word for judge the world. But that the world be saved or salved be him or saved by him. So you see how the language is going here and what they're trying to do. You can find all this online. It's out there for free. But we'll see how that all goes. Now, something changes, and this is one of the things that massively changes, that changes everything. In 1450, the Gutenberg printing press is developed, and this revolutionizes Western civilization. The movable type printing press is a landmark invention by Gutenberg. And if you go to the Houston Baptist Bible Museum that's open to the public, you can see a facsimile of a Gutenberg press and what it would have looked like. So this is a mock-up of what an old Gutenberg press would have looked like with the movable type and so forth. And it took time, but it was amazing. You could produce things, mass-produce things. And the Bible was one of the things that began to be mass-produced at a high level. And this began changing everything. So we are we're at the end of the early period. We're moving into the late period. So the next major Bible translation is from William Tyndale. And what we find is that he does this from 1525 to 1530. I'll give you a little info on William Tyndale. This is the first English translation that we know of from Hebrew and Greek. Tyndale was extremely well-educated, and he created his translation from Hebrew and Greek. This translation informed most of the major translations through the end of the 1600s. Tyndale was martyred. He was strangled and then burnt at the stake. On October 6th, you can still go to the place in Cambridge where there's an X, sort of like with Kennedy. There's an X on the street. That's where he was burned at the stake. They strangled him in private. But then his last words before he was strangled were, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes that he may be able to let his people ultimately," this is what he was getting at, "have access to the scriptures." This created much of the language that's used in translation, that is English translations moving forward, and actually to the point that 80% of the King James Bible can be traced to Tyndale's translations. 80% of the King James Bible can be traced to Tyndale's translations. Let me give you a little glimpse. This is of Tyndale's first edition. You can find first editions. There are a number of Bible sellers that will sell you one. It's going to set you back about $250,000 for a complete one. King James 1611s are a whole lot more pricey, just saying. But they're a lot. This is significantly rare. I wouldn't recommend anybody go buy one. Go look at one in the museum, or if you buy one, give it to a museum. That's really what you want to do with these things. But it sort of gives you the illumination that's going on. There is some standardization. You'll notice that the text here is in lines, that there's not a lot of movement and variance in between the lines because they were using a printing press and so forth. Let me give you a little bit of another example. This is a later edition that has some interesting features on it. You'll see how there's some indents. This is how they communicated the verses. Then off to the left, off to your right, my left, there is a commentary piece, sort of an explanatory note on what's going on in this passage. And then you move into the next chapter there that happens, and you see a few things that are going on with that. This is William Tyndale's John 3:16-18. "For God so loveth the world, yet he hath given his only Son, that none that believe in him should perish, but should have everlasting life." And you see the way that they're going about translating it. This is pretty straightforward because we're still using all the same letters at this point. The Arabic lettering or Arabic numerals are in place, and then English lettering are obviously in place. "For God sent not his Son into the world but to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He that believeth on him shall not be condemned or compend, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he believeth not in the name of the only Son. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how they do that. And now, even if you go over to England today, they have a couple different vowels that they'll throw in every now and then. They have an affection for yous for some reason. So color is cooler, and so forth. Our C-O-L-O-R is C-O-L-O-U-R. And you'll get really messed up if you accidentally in Word put on the wrong dictionary, because you need the U.S. dictionary, not the English dictionary. But that gives you an example of again, we're seeing the progression in the English language of what's going on. Several other English Bibles would result. About 50 English Bibles would appear between 1526 and 1611. Now, these are partial translation or whole translations. These would result. And now, they wouldn't necessarily all be done by scholars like Tyndale, but they would sometimes use Tyndale's text and then try to improve upon it. Or they would try to just produce something. The Psalms are a particularly unique partial that arises. Also, the Gospels are very important. And some of the Pauline literature is what you're going to see. Miles Coverdale was very significant. He actually assisted Tyndale and then lasted after Tyndale, because he wasn't martyred when Tyndale was. And he produced the Coverdale Bible in 1535. He would also revise the Geneva Bible in 1560. The Geneva Bible would become the Bible of the Puritan movement for several reasons. One, because it came through the blood of a martyr. The second reason was it wasn't touched by the Church of England or Catholic hands in terms of its translation, so they found it to be faithful. And third, because it was a vernacular translation of the Holy Scriptures, the Geneva Bible was on the Mayflower when it came over to the United States. You can actually still go and find some Reformed some very interesting Reformed congregations that use the Geneva Bible. A little bit more updated translation, but it was done by Coverdale. The Great Bible during this period was ordered by King Henry VIII of England in 1538, and this was what was used in the local churches and the cathedrals for readings. This was they began the process of creating an authorized text. Now, there wasn't a legal declaration of this, but this is what began being used. The Bishop's Bible of 1538, I've also think I threw it in your notes, 1609, because there was a revision that came out. That becomes really the primary text, and that comes off of the Great Bible. Then the Reims-Douay Catholic translation of 1609 becomes the official translation of the Catholic Church in England. These are all competing. They're all running around, and there's a lot of proliferation that's happening. But it's all leading up to one momentous event. And that's why we turn our page to get to that momentous event, which is the King James Bible. There is no more significant Bible in the history of the English language than the King James Bible. Yes, sir.
My presumption is that most of these now are all being printed.
Yes.
So that they were much more legible.
Yes. Yes, all of these are being printed by this point, because we're seeing massive advances in the press. I mean, we're into the 1600s, things are coming along, so they're all being printed, they're legible, people are able to buy them a bit cheaper than only a rich person was able to have. So yeah, that's why you're seeing the proliferation. So again, you're seeing sort of a line back with these first initial translations, and it's starting to creep upwards. And then here comes the great Bible, the King James Bible, the authorized Bible that was created in 1611. Just a couple things, real quick, couple notes. I don't have these in your notes necessarily. These are based in the Bishop's Bible, but with its own unique style. It was the first sanctioned, authorized translation of the Bible in England. This was created to appease Puritans and other dissenters. And it did an okay job for a little while. It was authorized by James I, who was a unique person in and of himself. And it was used the Church of England leaders and theologians and scholars to begin the process of translating. When they went to translate, they used, as we're going to see, they used the Textus Receptus, which is from Erasmus. But they also were able to draw on a number of other things, including almost all of them had a copy of Tyndale's Bible sitting on their sort of their mantle that was sort of underneath some papers in case one of the officials came through. This also created revenues for the Crown Press. Don't think this isn't the case, because there's a lot of money in Bible sales, especially when you control the market. And the one of the ways that the Church of England, well, actually the Crown, was able to create significant revenues is they had the royal printer was authorized to print the Bible. And there's a whole storyline. If you want a really interesting storyline of scandal and accusation and all those kinds of things, one of the and larceny and theft and bankruptcy and all those kinds of all the good stuff. Look at the history of who was printing the English Bible, the King James Bible. These kinds of things go on. But then also, this would become the dominant. This would become the dominant, it should be dominant, English translation for the next 300 years. Nothing compares to the King James Bible until the mid-1900s, just being very frank, in terms of its proliferation. And then the translators used Erasmus Textus Receptus, Greek text, for the New Testament. They also used the Septuagint, as well as some Hebrew for the Old Testament, Masoretic texts and so forth. And they created perhaps the single greatest contribution to the English language in printed form. This is a copy. This is a flyleaf from an actual King James 1611. This is the Book of Deuteronomy. I have this in my office. You can see some different factors, and we'll have this up here. You can come and look at it, but I'll have a blow-up of another page. You have some marginal notes with cross-references. You'll also notice that this is one page. And when we open our Bibles, when they're opened up, have two pages. So you can imagine when you get up on your pulpit on Sunday morning and you lay this open, it's very easy to read. I can read it from almost back here for certain things, but when you get up on it, you're able to see some of the stuff that goes on. There was not an illuminated text yet. That would come along. But the challenge with this is, because of its size, I mean, the thing, if you go up to Lanier Theological Library, which is in Champion Forest, and you go in, it's a great place to go to visit for an afternoon or something like that. When you walk in, there are two copies of the English, of the 1611 King James on either side. The He Bible is on the right, and the She Bible is on the left. And we call them the He Bible and the She Bible because of different misprints. One of the challenges of the first 10 years of the King James Bible is it had a variety of misprints that would come up. One of the printers actually lost his license to print the King James because in the Ten Commandments, he left out a very important not, which was, thou shalt not commit adultery. So it began to be changed. I actually have right here, sort of give you a little, it's kind of fun, I've got a couple pages that I printed up for myself. A lot of these have different names, like the Judas Bible. The Judas Bible has Judas, not Jesus, saying, sit ye here while I go wander and pray. So the Judas Bible, it's just a misprint, because they were moving along and they just happened to do this. Let me see another one. The Fool's Bible in Psalm 14:1 reads, the fool hath said in his heart, there is a God. So you see little things like this. The Wife-Hater Bible in 1810 replaces life in this edition, making Luke 14:26 redundantly read, if any man come to me, hate not his father and his mother and his wife and his children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own wife also, he cannot be my disciple. So you're supposed to hate your wife twice. There's just a lot of things like this. There's actually this is technical literature. It cost $185 brand new, but there's a book out there written by a guy called Textual Criticism in the King James Bible. He goes through all the editions of the King James Bible, and he pulls out where there are manuscript errors. And they arise because people are people. And there's a whole conversation to be had. We live in a day that's quite amazing in terms of history. We have actual translations of the Bible and translations of documents that are consistent. And that has not been, for most of history, been able to be seen. So a couple other points real quick. This is sort of the title page of the King James Bible in the 1611. There's a whole lot going on here. and what you can see. You'll see, and I'll get my little pointer do. Where'd my little pointer do go? There it is. I don't know. It's not going to come up on the screen. But you'll see a few things. There are a number of people that are all significant on that page. One of the things that we get, it's the Holy Bible containing the Old Testament and the New. One of the things, let me read it on my actual piece right here, because I want to get this right. That middle section says, newly translated out of the original tongues and with the former translations diligently compared and rectified by His Majesty's special commandment, appointed to be read in all the churches, imprinted at London by Robert Barker. Robert Barker was the first printer of the King James Bible, and he made a ton of money printing Bibles. Then he misspelled something, and he lost his license, just the way these things go. But as we can see, that's the title page. There's just a whole lot going on with that, and we don't have too much time. This is, as I mentioned before, this is sort of, this is a copy of the Epistle to Paul to the Acts of Romans. It's not different than what you see right here. You have your header, you have some of your script that goes in there, and you have some really unique features that go into each one. Sort of the chapter that gets into that, sort of giving some examples. On either side, you'll see the marginal notes. Those are cross-references, stuff that we take for granted. These were innovations in text at the time. So this is the King James Bible. And so forth. Let me get this thing moving along here. A couple other notes about the King James. It has been revised. If anyone tells you the King James Bible has not been revised, they're not up to date. The major revision was in 1769. If you currently use a King James Bible, it is a 1769 translation. It has numerous minor revisions that have gone on. I've got a whole page of them right here if you want to read them. But also the most recent revision is the New King James Bible. And that came out in 1982, as we'll see here in a few moments. It represents the greatest contribution to the English language ever printed. We cannot underestimate how significant the King James Bible has been. It has basically created the foundation for so many documents. So much of the language that we use between Shakespeare and the English Bible and the King James Bible has been absolutely informed by it. And then finally, the second to last point here, in 1662 it was tied to the Book of Common Prayer. This made the King James Bible the natural first book any household in England would ever get. So that's just how that really significant paired it up. It is also one of the most widely distributed books in the history of mankind. The King James Bible has been all over the world before anything else. It was quicker than the English Empire to make sure the sun never set on it. It was used across the mission fields and has been one of the most significant texts. But we should also remember it is not God. And those people who say it was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me, are not right. And we have to be careful with that. I'll give you a couple quick texts real quick. You'll see the two differences here between the 1611 text on this side and the 1769 text on this side. The 1769 is probably what a lot of us grew up with. If I just said the Lord's Prayer, having recited that, that's the 1769 translation. But here, I mean, we look, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The 1611, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. But the way that they use language is different then. So you see a bit of the changes in English language, and this is perpetuating the differences in what's happening. I actually have some people that I know online, they're not nice people, that go to a 1611 King James only church. They read the 1611 King James Bible every Sunday morning, and they will not use anything else. They're quite confusing to talk to. And it's a challenge. It's that King James only movement. But anyways, let's sort of get into the thick and thin of it to try to go through a few things here, and we'll keep moving down because I want to be a good steward of your time. Between 1700 and 1900, there are a number of translations in English that appear. And just to give you an example, I've got 10 pages, pretty well cut in half, of different translations that appear. Let me read a couple off to you. The Primitive New Testament was done by William Whitson in 1745. John Wesley had a translation of the New Testament that he did, or somebody did for him, But Wesley was a pretty sharp guy. But then you also had Gilbert Wakefield, a translation of the New Testament, came out in 1791. The Holy Bible, containing the Old and New Covenant, commonly called the Old and New Testament, translated from the Greek by Charles Thomson, late secretary to the Congress of the United States, was done in 1808. That was four volumes. This is an interesting one. In 1826, Alexander Campbell. And where do we know Alexander Campbell from? Well, that's where the Churches of Christ came from. He created the sacred writing of the apostles and evangelists of Jesus Christ, commonly styled the New Testament, translated from the original Greek by George Campbell, James MacKnight, and Philip Doddridge, doctors of the Church of Scotland, with prefaces to the historical and epistolatory books and an appendix containing critical notes of various translations of difficult passages. Noah Webster, the Holy Bible, containing the Old and New Testaments in the Common Version with amendments to the language. Now, that's interesting because this is the next thing that we want to point out, that there are some translations that are based in the King James Bible text, and Daniel Webster's is one of them. He didn't know Greek or Hebrew, but he improved on the King James Bible. He tried to update the language in the 1800s. So this is the kind of thing that's going on. So we see that in English, there are adaptions that are happening, that are going on throughout the 1700s and the 1800s. Some other ones that come from the Hebrew and Greek are like the Quaker Bible in 1764, Young's Literal Translation in 1862, the English Revised Version in 1885. This is the most important late 1800s translation of the English Bible because, and I'll talk about this here in a moment, it leverages the critical texts that were being created by people like Westcott and Hort. It uses modern tools of hermeneutics, exegesis, archaeology, and textual critical studies. The English Revised Version changed the entire nature of Bible translation in the late 1800s. And then, this is a real unique one, it's actually fairly good, this is the first translation of the Bible done by a woman. She was taught by her father Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, and she sat down at the end of her life in her 60s and 70s and created a translation of the Bible. And her name was Julia E. Smith Parker, and she did this in 1876. She created about 2,000 copies and sold them for $2.50 each. And you can find the entire text of this online. And it's actually a fairly good translation, which isn't to be a surprise, but it's not done by a professor, it's not done by a pastor, and it's not done by a textual critical scholar. It's done by a lay person who is well-educated. So that we see that there's a proliferation, there's a growth of Bible, of English Bible translations in this time. So there's not a vacuum in between the NIV and the King James Bible that happens. But the 20th century sees an explosion of Bible translations. And some of this is due to the creation of the critical study of the Bible, coupled with developments in textual criticism and archaeological discoveries. What happened, we talked about this several weeks ago, what happened sort of towards the mid, sort of after what we would consider to be the Civil War, so about 1870 on, English or German influences are coming in because archaeology is now beginning to establish a method. We're finding documents, they're finding them in monasteries, they're digging them up in other places. One of the most significant finds that ever happened in the 20th century was what? It was the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some kid was playing up on a ledge and threw a rock down into a cave, and he heard something shatter, and he wandered down there, and he found caves upon caves of these clay jars that were sealed that had thousands of year old scrolls. And you can, if you go up to Lanier Theological Library, see some fragments. If you go to the Museum of the Bible that's going to open in Washington, D.C., you can actually see an entire Dead Sea Scroll laid out in front of you. All these kinds of things that are going on. What's interesting, and this is kind of fun if you want to do it, if you go up to a place like Lanier Theological Library, they have this giant display case that is probably about as half a long as this room, and they have a facsimile of the scroll of Jeremiah laid out. And you can take your Hebrew Bible, and you can begin at the one end, and you can, well, actually, you can begin at the one end, no, the one end, and you can work your way all the way through. So you start over here, because it's Hebrew, and you go all the way down the scroll. And you can read the book of Jeremiah. And it's kind of neat how that all happens. But what happens is that we begin seeing an explosion in Bible. There's a lot of other reasons for it, too. So we enter the modern era. The development of the critical text of the Bible by Westcott and Hort in 1881 is a massive shift. And these were two scholars that were living in England that began recreating sort of the textual critical devices. They began looking at various manuscripts, and they began pulling together a critical text of the New Testament and the Old Testament, but primarily focused on the New Testament. And that creates it. And like I mentioned before, the English Revised Version reflects this shift, and it begins changing everything. So just to give you, there's a chart that you guys have maybe have seen before. I don't know if you have or not. This is a neat little chart. You can find it all over the place in Google. But this is sort of a graphical representation of how we got the English Bible. It's actually pretty good because it's updated. Gives you down here, you have your original manuscripts down at the bottom. Then you have your ancient copies, the Masoretic, the ancient versions. Dead Sea Scrolls are over here because they inform our modern translations, but the Dead Sea Scrolls weren't around to inform Miles Coverdale. They weren't around to inform the guys that were there. But then it goes all the way up. You'll see the Coverdale Bible, the Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the King James Bible, the Douay-Rheims Bible, and then you get the English Revised Version. And that right there, the English Revised Version, if I can get my little pointer, I don't think my pointer is going to work. I can't see it, but that before you see that line, that English Revised Version in 1881, that reflects a massive shift in the nature of Bible translations in English. This is out there a lot. I mean, it's free. I download it for free. So let me give you just a rundown of some modern translations with a couple annotations, and I'm going to try to wrap up after this. So you've got them all right here. The American Standard Version, ASV, this was a very significant translation in 1901. The JPS, or the Jewish Publication Society, in 1917. The Amplified Bible in 1965. What happens, though, I will throw this out there, a couple of my illustration points. This is a really interesting volume. This is called 26 Translations of the New Testament. And it's got 26 different translations of the New Testament in it, and they all have different different things. They come from a period in between between basically 1920 and 1960, with some other new ones as well. But you have things in here from the New Testament in Modern English from the Judson Press in 1924. You've got a couple other ones in here from Moody Bible Institute, the New Testament, translated by Charles Williams from 1936. So we have a lot of translations that are going on. This is interesting because it creates kind of that parallel that happens. This is a copy of the Amplified Bible. The Amplified Bible is interesting because it creates through a series of textual changes where it wants to add different clarifying notes. This was really interesting for study because nobody had ever done that before. But you'll see as you're going through and you're reading some stuff, particularly in the New Testament, they'll add in with brackets or italics or parentheses clarifying words that'll happen with that. And that came out, as we mentioned, in 1965 and so forth. But then we also have the Jerusalem Bible. This was the first Catholic Bible fully translated in English, in modern English. That happened in 1966. The New English Bible, 1970. The Good News Bible, 1976 and 1992. My first Bible that I was handed when I was in first grade was a Good News Bible. And I carried that thing with me until it fell. Actually, I've still got it in one of my boxes if I want to pull it out. Had some great stuff in it. But also the New American Standard Bible came out in 1977. But then there are some challenges because they kept the vowels and the V's in there, so they needed to update it. So in 1995, they updated the New American Standard. So in the if you ever see, you see an NASB, that could be a 1977 one. But if you see NASU, that's definitely the updated one from 1995. Then we have the New International Version from 1978, 1984, and 2011. The New King James came out in 1982, the New Jerusalem Bible, which corresponds to the one from 66 in 1985, the New Jewish Publication Society. I actually use this when I'm doing Old Testament work because it's a very good translation of the Old Testament. What's that? That's only the Old Testament. Yes, yeah, and it has all the other all the other parts of that. The Revised English Bible. I use the Revised English Bible when I'm doing some study as well. These two right here, the JPS and then the REB. I love the REB. The REB was translated by a couple of unique guys that had a lot of good insight on the various texts that they were translating. The New Revised Standard Version, this is what you're going to find in a lot of Episcopalian churches, a lot of United Church of Christ's, some Roman Catholic churches, more mainline denominations will utilize this because of the depth of research behind it. The Contemporary English Version, the CEV, 1995. The New Living Translation in 1996. But then also, what else do we have? Then we have the Holman Christian Standard Bible in 2004. On Sunday mornings, I use the Holman Christian Standard Bible when I preach. I've just enjoyed it. I use it as my second year of Greek. They were coming out with it, and I used it during that time, and I really liked a lot of what they said. It's very readable. But then also the New English Translation in 2005, and I left one off that's very significant. It's called the English Standard Version, the ESV, and it came out in 2010. So you see, we've got this trickle of Bible translations, and all of a sudden we get to the 20th century, and it's like the doors have been flung open. And we have a ton of them that happens. Now, there's a couple other ones that come out. There are some recent innovations. They're really not as some of them are popular, but they're out there. There are some fun ones. J.B. Phillips New Testament. I've got a J.B. Phillips New Testament right here. It's kind of fun. J.B. Phillips was a pastor, and he just tried to create stuff in modern vernacular. It's not a direct translation. He used a number of versions, and he created his stuff. One of the things, greet each other with a holy kiss, becomes greet each other with a hearty handshake, and stuff like that. So trying to reflect some movement in the time. The Cotton Patch Bible. Has anybody heard of the Cotton Patch Bible? Yeah, one of the reasons the Cotton Patch Bible is so popular is because Jimmy Carter had it in the Oval Office with him. It's sort of a southernized version of the I guess, communicating the New Testament and the Old Testament in southern terms. Jesus wasn't crucified. Jesus was lynched. So some interesting things going on there. The Living Bible came out in 1971. Many of you are probably familiar with that. When I was, this is my mom's copy. Actually, I took it from her, borrowed it, and we'll return it when she asks for it. But it's the Living Bible, very good paraphrase, and is a forerunner for the next one, which is the Message. Fun story from me, when I grew up in a town called Bel Air, Maryland, and I went to a preschool at a place called Christ Our King Lutheran Church that was right outside of our neighborhood where I grew up, and they had a very nice man who was the pastor there. I don't remember him too much because I was far more interested in Lego or the building blocks and all that kind of stuff and the little horse to ride in the corner. But he would come and he would do wonderful little talks and he'd play a guitar, and his name was Eugene Peterson. And he is the person who created the Message translation. He was actually working on that when I was 5 years old. It's a paraphrase. These are all paraphrases or partial translations. And there's a number of others that come up with that. So I'll give you a little bit of show and tell with these things and so forth. Anyways, as I mentioned sort of in the last parts, we are living in times where there's been an explosion of English Bible translations. However, since 1600, there have been alternative. Since about 1600, there have been alternatives, and no singular translation has been used by Christians in English-speaking countries. There's always been a diversity. Many of our modern translations are very good translations that employ discoveries in biblical criticism, archaeology, and exegesis. And I would say that we are in a better place where we are scholarly-wise. But we have to be careful because there are also heretical translations of the Bible. The New World Translation, if you hear about this, it is not a good translation of the Bible because it's done by the Watchtower Society, and we also call them the Jehovah's Witnesses. For instance, in the first chapter of John, it says, instead of saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, It says, in the beginning, the Word was a God, and a God was with the Word. So what they do is they, instead of taking, they violate a very specific Greek rule, and they try to create this is a technical term, and an arthrous construction where an arthrous construction exists. So instead of being specific with the article the, they try to create non-specific by calling it a. So it removes divinity from Jesus Christ, and it tries to say that God was just kind of out there. And he was around the place. No. John is specific in the Greek. There was the Word, and the Word was God. Jesus Christ is the Word. Another one that came out in the 1800s, and this is one that we have to be very careful about because they're going to come and start knocking on our doors this summer, is the Mormon, the Joseph Smith translation of the King James Version, or the King James Bible. He updated it, having no biblical studies backgrounds whatsoever. He updated it, and tried to provide that for folks. So that's what we've got. That's the history of the English Bible.